This podcast is brought to you by DKP & Co. Chartered Accountants. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hello, I'm your host, Louise Taffer, with Josh Parrish. It's great to have your company this evening as we approach the end of another week, the start of the weekend, which is always our favourite time because it's when the action starts. And tonight there's action aplenty, isn't there, Josh?
There is indeed. A-League action all through the weekend. How many of these games matter is the question, I suppose. But
one or two.
Yeah, we might see a few young players, a few rotations. So there's always curiosities. And as we saw on Anzac Day, in some of these games where there's not as much on the line can actually result in some good entertainment.
I don't know how good that is for Adelaide United. A leaky defence as they approach the finals, something that they'll really want to tighten up because that can't be too good.
Well, they've also had trouble scoring goals all season, so you can spin it any way you like, I suppose. Any game against Brisbane Roar almost can't be taken as, you know, as a measure for anything in particular. But tonight we will see Melbourne City taking on Central Coast Mariners. Central Coast always, you know, playing for pride, and Melbourne City are going to have to rack up an enormous scoreline if they're going to move up in the finals, which seems unlikely.
And to take us through it all is we're going to go straight to our journo's program because right now is the Guardian's Jonathan Howcroft joining us. Jonathan, it's great to have your company on the show.
Thank you very much. Good to speak to you both.
Josh just touched on the City Central Coast Mariners game this evening. Melbourne City's Warren Joyce did say he wants to beat the Mariners by 8-0, if possible. Is that just a lack of respect for the opposition, who, despite their position at the bottom of the table, have proved at certain parts, even though sporadically throughout the season, to be somewhat competitive?
Oh, I don't know. I try not to buy into those kind of storylines too much. I think that might just be a bit of Warren's northern sense of humour, because he knows that the preferred outcome tonight would be a couple, two or three, enough for them to win, get some momentum heading into the finals, but not actually jeopardise having to travel interstate for that first week of the finals. They want Melbourne victory. That's the best outcome for them. If they're not going to host a game, they only want it to be down the road. So that's absolutely the best case scenario for them. So instead of having that that debate about, if you're 3-0 up, do you sub off Jamie McLaren or any of those kind of conversations, just go massively over the top. Say you want to win 8-0 and just shut that conversation down.
Absolutely. And do you think it's maybe best for them to play a derby in the finals? Because for some reason, I don't know, it's a psychological thing, they seem to get up for these games and Victory haven't beaten them this season.
100%. It's just a total no-brainer. And it's, unfortunately for Victory fans, it is the worst case scenario for them, because you know that over the course of a season, Victory have proven themselves to be a demonstrably better team with a much higher ceiling. But when it all comes down to a one-off scenario, you can't take anything for granted. And like you say, City absolutely raised their status for these matches. They've got big game players. And Victory will be coming towards the end of a long campaign. They've had the Asian Champions League as a distraction recently. A few of their star players are looking just a little bit tired. They've got a couple of injuries creeping in as well. So a confident performance, not necessarily based on the scoreline, but a victory and a confident performance from Melbourne City tonight will shake up the next few days, I think, and create quite a tasty narrative heading into that final.
And we touch on the Melbourne Victory. Kevin Muscat has actually said that Lawrence Thomas is battling some soreness and won't be able to play against Western Sydney Wanderers. Do we read into that? Is he on his way out the door?
But this storyline has baffled me over the past few weeks. And reading between the lines, clearly, I can't put those two things together, can I? Reading between the lines, one can infer that there's a problem in that relationship. I don't see personally what Lawrence Thomas has done to not continue as a first choice goalkeeper for Victory. This time last year, he was the standout player in the competition. So there's something going on that we can't, you know, we can't tell on this side of the fence. But Matt Acton has done a great job in deputising. So on you know, purely form basis, I don't think there's a lot to lose at the moment between them. But it does surprise when you look at what has made Victory such a successful operation over a long period of time: consistency, backing players through good form and bad, and this just feels, you know, whether the full story will eventually come out, it does feel like Kevin Muscat is trying a particular tactic to get a response out of his player and potentially more players besides who might have thought that their places were secure when maybe taking a bit for granted. So it remains to be seen, but you know, Kevin Muscat has proven himself over recent years that he knows what he's doing. So sometimes from the outside looking in, it might not seem a logical decision that's been taken, but you trust the judgment of the person making it.
And just outside of the, you know, the immediate context, do you think Lawrence Thomas does need to move abroad to, you know, maybe further his career? Because, you know, in my opinion, he's achieved everything there is to achieve as a goalkeeper in the A-League. You know, he's won a Joe Marston medal. He's been the best keeper in the competition. Maybe this is time for him to move on and pursue opportunities abroad.
Absolutely, especially if his first team place is no longer guaranteed, or the suggestion that life is just a bit too comfortable for him at the moment, then absolutely a new challenge would be in order. And his stock is high. He's a good age. He's got great experience. He's a big game player. So you wouldn't think that he'd struggle to find a decent home to go to. And the reputation of Australian goalkeepers around the world is a strong one. So he's got a lot in his favour if he does want to do that. And I struggle a bit with the logic of sometimes in Australian football that there's the A-League is just a gateway to another opportunity. But I think in an example like this, it does make a lot of sense for a new league and a new challenge. So yeah, I think you're probably right, Josh.
And you'd have to say that if Matt Acton did become the first choice goalkeeper heading into the final series, do you think that would be a little bit of a backward step for the Victory, given that Lauren Thomas has proven himself throughout the regular season?
Yeah, I think on form, Matt Acton has done well since he's come in. He's made some eye-catching saves, and he fills the shirt very similarly, doesn't he? They have a very similar presence. And you know, one argument from a coaching point of view is that you want a form, and the person, for whatever reason, whether it's a suspension or an injury or tiredness or whatever it happens to be, if you're in possession of the shirt and you played well, you deserve to keep it. And I can imagine that at this stage of the season that Kevin Muscat will be playing the mind games as much as possible to get the most out of his team. And if one of those tricks is by retaining Matt Acton, then so be it.
And while we're on the subject of Melbourne Victory, Jonathan, there was an interesting segment during the coverage of the Asian Champions League on Foxtel on Tuesday, where Mark Bosnich used the goal of Victory conceded as an example of you know, why Australian teams shouldn't continue to insist on playing out from the back at all times. I wanted to get your perspective on that, because I think it hits at the heart of a sort of central divide in ideology in Australian football.
Yeah, it's a difficult example to comment on generally, but just because it was so badly executed, and it felt like the very start of that process from the goalkeeper playing the ball out. It was a bad decision at that point, and then it was compounded by successive poor decisions. You'd probably have to go back to Kevin Muscat and the logic of how he set out his team to perform on that night. I think what we sometimes struggle with is we have certain common sense approaches to the game. I've got them from my background. There's a kid growing up in the 80s in Northern England. There are certain truisms that you bring with you into how you watch football. And they need to adapt over time, and it's difficult to adapt them sometimes. You look at the challenges that Ange Postecoglou had, particularly in the last year or two of his time at the Socceroos, trying to get across to people that there's no magic, there's no hocus pocus in a back three. It's just there's still 11 players on a pitch, and you're just trying to manipulate space in different ways and use different approaches to try and control the game. And I think what you'd have to do is ask Kevin Muscat how relevant that passage of play was to the overall structure of what he was trying to accomplish. If they were trying to suck the opposition in and create space further down the pitch, then absolutely, there's a risk-reward involved in the process that they took. They just executed it badly. I think the challenge that the comments that Bozza raised were that clearing your lines first, defend first, clear the danger as far down the pitch as possible is a truism that lasted for a long time and perhaps remains accurate in that instance. But in the context of a much broader approach to playing the game, I don't think it's as black and white as that. And I think we have to be a bit more sophisticated in how we think about breaking down those situations. But clearly in that instance, it went wrong, and there's no challenge that has to be called out. And the point of Bozza in those instances is to call it out and say, that failed. I think my layer on top of that would be, I think we just have to be a bit careful about saying it failed because it's inherently wrong. It failed in that instance, yes, but was the overall process necessarily wrong? And I think that's up for debate.
I do too, Jonathan. I think if you look at the very top echelons of football, the playing through a press is one of the most core tenets of that, those developments at the very top of the game. And it seems to be, a question of whether Australian football is trying to work within its means and adopt a sort of standard underdog mentality, make it difficult for the highly paid, Chinese team and put numbers behind the ball, all that kind of traditional, conventional wisdom, or whether there's maybe a little bit more of an aspiration in the way you're trying to play. Maybe there's a bigger goal at stake, maybe further down the line. And I think, it seems to touch on the legacy of Ange Postecoglou, given that he's managed the Socceroos and Melbourne Victory, and his imprint is still there at that club. And transitioning, to a new regime that's sort of in charge of Australian football, whether you have holdovers from that regime.
Yeah, I agree exactly with what you've said. You have to have the players to do it, and you have to have had the coaching and the players drilled into the routine and the repetition of what the patterns and of the different phases look like. But shifting to a different competition, you look at the dominance of Liverpool and Manchester City in the Premier League. If you're in a similar situation like that against an opposition like that, and you just boot it out of your defence, it's back in your final third in two or three seconds. So the logic that just getting rid is necessarily an advance on that position doesn't necessarily hold true, especially when you've got teams that are so good at recycling in transition so quickly that, sometimes the best form of defence is attack. And if that attack has to build from that far down the pitch, I agree with what you're saying that I think how we approach the game as a whole perhaps needs to be a bit more nuanced.
And Jonathan, some of the latest news this week is the appointment of Liverpool legend Robbie Fowler. Brisbane Roar have actually set an unwarranted A-League record, having conceded the most ever goals in an A-League season, that being 71. The club is certainly looking towards better days. What do you think Robbie Fowler might bring to the job?
Yeah, it's a good question. My answer is I've got no idea because he's never managed at the highest level before. We know he's got all his badges. We know that he was an extraordinary talented footballer, one of the best footballers that I ever saw in the flesh. At his peak, he was outstanding. My answer to the whole Robbie Fowler thing, I know it's polarised, as anything does in Australian football, it's polarised. Mine is that it's less actually about Robbie Fowler himself and more about the structure that the backer group put around him. Mm. We know that the high performing A-League teams have good football operations managers, that there's a good relationship between the front office and the back office, and that there's a long-term strategic vision. It's demonstrable that that hasn't happened at Brisbane in recent seasons. They've lost more games each year for the past three seasons. They've squad turn, the list management, that's the phrase I was looking for, has been problematic with a large number of older players and a large number of younger players, and not necessarily blending the two successfully, or having a lot of players in that sweet spot, which we know works in the A-League. So I think it's paramount that Shane Stefanuto, who is now the football operations manager, has a long-term vision, because they've got a lot of good kids. They've still got some decent top-end talent. They just need to figure out where they are in 2, 3, 4 years' time. Next season, they just have to accept it's a transitional season. They need to give, we all need to give Fowler a season just to get his feet under the table. And, you know, a bit like Marcus Babbel this season, figure out which players he wants to keep, who he wants to bring in, which players suit the style of play that he wants to develop, and then you start judging them on season two and onwards. But they have to be in a position where at the start of season two you know exactly where they're going and that they can get to where they want to, because just bringing in Fowler alone as a coach isn't going to do a great deal with one off season to make any kind of changes. They need to be much longer term, and we need to be patient as a football community in allowing them to do that.
The problem I have with that, Jonathan, is the backer group, in my eyes, haven't really demonstrated anything to suggest that we should be trusting them with the as custodians of that club. I mean, there's been some disastrous times. I mean, maybe it's leveled out recently, but there were times where they weren't paying the players on time. You know, there was questions about the financial viability of the club's future. But they do have a new training base now, which is a great development, I'm sure. But you know, do you have any faith in the backroom group as owners?
That's a great point to raise, and I think custodian is the perfect word to use as well. No, my answer is I don't have a lot of faith in their ability to do that. But I think the point that you made about the training base now with Robbie Fowler as coach, if they are upholding their end of the bargain behind the scenes, then hopefully it then becomes about the football, not about the administration. And if the football brains can figure out amongst themselves, then it ceases to really be about the backer's ownership. But you're absolutely right that they have been culpable in recent seasons as to why there's been a downturn in results for Brisbane.
And given Robbie's high profile, which players would you like to see him bring out to Australia, or even just sign in general?
Yeah, I don't really buy into that too much as speculation. I guess all I would say to that is I'd like to think that there will be a signing or two that are a consequence of his status. Because that's what you're buying. When you're signing Robbie Fowler, you are signing a player with access to players. It doesn't really matter necessarily where they are in their careers. Like Liverpool won the FA Youth Cup last night. And to that generation of kids, Robbie Fowler would be an absolute hero. So is it at that level? Is it more that there's a generation of senior pros who are coming to the end of their careers that he played with at a different stage in his Premier League lifetime that might be looking for a couple of seasons somewhere warm, somewhere sunny. I don't really mind necessarily, but I think if you are going to get something like Fowler in, you do want to see a demonstration of the reach that he gives you, but you know, whether that's a high profile name or not, I'm not overly bothered.
I think he's at least good for a few newspaper headlines in Brisbane where they don't usually get the coverage. I mean, just the nickname, and it's a headline writer's dream. So maybe if he can coach, you can maybe lead to some, you know, positive coverage up in Queensland. But there's something completely different I want to finish on, Jonathan. And, you know, maybe it's a hornet's nest of opinions, but there's NCIP has again reared its head. I thought this policy was scrapped. Joseph Crotzy was out on Twitter saying that it had been scrapped and they were developing a new policy. There was a media release to that effect a few months back, but Northern New South Wales Football have continued to enforce this sort of lame duck policy in its absence. What's your read on this situation? You know, is it incumbent upon the state federations to keep enforcing this when FFA said themselves it's not suitable?
Oh, it's a complete no-win situation, this one. The FFA, when the FFA announced that the NCIP would be replaced, the indication from that and the read amongst the football community was that the existing policy had ended and a new one would be brought in. But there's a lag time between actually bringing that new policy in. And until that new policy is in, the existing one stands, and that's the problem. So it's a bit like a good comparison, like a caretaker government, perhaps, almost, where you still have to enforce the rules as they are until there's new ones that can be applied. It does feel very much like Northern New South Wales haven't read the room and have made a decision based on poor logic. That, but in their defence, they were applying the letter of the law, and that's, you know, that's their remit. So it is a complete no-win situation, and again brings into focus the challenges of communication that we all, you know, we're all excited that there are now board members who are approachable and accessible on social media, but it only enhances the shades of grey in the conversation if it's not clear cut what the situation happens to be. So not for the first time, I think Joseph Carozzi and you know, we've seen it with Rima Nogaroto before and Heather Reid before that we do need to be very careful what we wish for in terms of that level of communication. But one would just hope that common sense prevails and FFA nudges Northern New South Wales to say, look, you know, this policy is being removed. There's no need to be overly officious unless it's absolutely necessary. And in this instance, it doesn't appear to be the case. So hopefully cool heads will prevail.
Well, Jonathan, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us here on Evenings on FNR. We always love hearing from you, and we look forward to speaking to you again very soon.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Jonathan Howcroft joining us from The Guardian Australia for our Journo segment. With that, Louise, I think we'll take a short break, but plenty more still to come, so stick with us.
Viva Global manufactures professional quality kits for grassroots clubs right through to professional teams and organisations. Specialising in custom-made performance sportswear, players are certain to look, feel and perform at their highest level. As proud kit providers of the A-League's Newcastle Jets, Viva strive to create a product that has a technical edge with a focus on performance apparel at all levels. Experience the difference with Viva today. For more details, visit their website, www.vivaglobal.com.au.
Since 1998, Lanco Group has been providing superior civil engineering solutions and advice to developers, local government and service authorities across Australia. Lanco Group is known for delivering sustainable, efficient solutions. By working closely with clients, Lanco Group is able to meet the complex infrastructure requirements for residential, commercial and industrial developments on time, on budget. Find out more at lancogroup.com.au. Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
You're with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And Josh, I wanted to ask you, did you see that game last night? Brisbane Roar defeated by Adelaide United. The score wasn't too pleasant. Brisbane Roar didn't look too good at all, despite some of the goals.
Yeah, it was insanity. It's sort of end of season, you know, players on the beach kind of thing. Obviously, Adelaide United have a finals campaign to look forward to. But, you know, Brisbane have been involved in some of these crazy scorelines this season. Sometimes they've been less than, you know, respectable. At least they were in that game up until the Isaias goal right at the end. But, yeah, it was a bit bizarre going backwards and forwards. And the ridiculous Eric Boetiak penalty was just the cherry on the cake.
But looking at their season as a whole, isn't that just incredible? The fact that they have set a record that they shouldn't have set, conceding the most ever A-League goals in any season. They've surpassed Wooden Spooners, Central Coast Mariners. They've conceded 71 goals. It's ridiculous, to be honest.
It's been shocking. And obviously I had concerns about them, and I think a lot of people did going into the season. I think I picked them to finish eighth, and they've, you know, been even worse than that, I think. I didn't expect much from them this season. Obviously, Adam Taggart's departure hurt them in games, but that defensive record, Adam Taggart has barely any impact on that. And they need to think about their makeup of their defence next season. You know, if they're going to have a season in which they have no hope of making finals, you know, why not give Aaron Reardon some A-League minutes at this level? See what he's got. Because I think he has potential. You know, he maybe made some errors in the games that he's played, but he's the kind of player that could be one for the future. And they've got the likes of Isaac Powell and so forth. So I think the youth is the one silver lining for them. But they need to really recruit heavily for the next season and have an overhaul of their squad, because they've had too many injuries for senior players and players that they knew would be injured, to be honest. Everybody knew that Brett Holman was going to miss a lot of games. He's basically missed all the games. So yeah, I think there's a lack of foresight and planning that's been behind all their struggles rather than the coaching changes.
And hopefully we can see that now under Robbie Fowler. It'll be interesting to see how he builds his squad.
It will be very interesting. Well, Robbie Fowler, we have no barometer for him as a coach, none at all. I mean, apparently he topped his A license, and yeah, he's been player manager of Muang Thong United for a few weeks back in the day. That's, I don't think, tremendously relevant. He's a big name, of course, and he'll be good for a couple of headlines. But as we saw with the Usain Bolt thing, you know, it's only good for a short period. And then you've got to back it up with real results, real performances. And Robbie Fowler will be under a lot of pressure next season. As Jonathan Alcroft just said in the previous segment, though, it's going to be down to the Backeries more than it will be down to Robbie Fowler in particular, because you need to support a new manager.
Of course, and we've seen that with Perth Glory. It's a top-down effect, and that's no doubt why they have achieved success this season.
If Tony Popovich couldn't have signed all the players that he did, you know, if he'd only been able to sign half those players, then the Perth Glory wouldn't have finished top of the league and be favourites for the championship.
Well, that's it. And he had to have the backing of Tony Pinata and also Tony Sage to give them the money.
Yeah, invested more money in the squad. They brought in quality across the park to complement what they already had there. And there's been a unifying vision across the team, how they were going to play, the formation they were going to set up with, you know, the systems, the structures, and that's been executed to a T. Brisbane Roar have had no such structures in place. You had no idea what the makeup of the squad was, you know, going to look like out on the field. It was just random bits and pieces.
And I think it's been like that for a few other clubs around the A-League this season. Nice. And it's evident in the way that they play. And unfortunately, if you don't have the support of your owners and the CEO, then it translates to the performances on the pitch.
And I think we're overly obsessed with coaches because they are the personalities in the press conferences, and, you know, we've built up these sort of caricatures of what they're like. And I think the cult of the manager in English football is sort of extended to Australian football. They're not the ones that success, you know, you live or die on. It's the players out on the field, first and foremost, but it's also the entire back room, the recruitment department, which the coaches aren't always solely responsible for, usually need some support, the sports science. There's so much else that goes into success at a club that people don't see. And to lay the blame or the credit squarely at the feet of the coach is, I think, misguided.
Now, Josh, we do know that the elimination finals dates are set. And Melbourne Victory will face either Melbourne City or Wellington Phoenix at Amy Park on Friday, the 3rd of May.
Yeah, so the derby in the finals is an exciting fixture. And Melbourne City, it's one game on the line for whether their season's been a abject failure or a pass mark. If they win this game and get to the A-League semi-finals, that's a pass mark, I suppose. You know, they've played some poor football this season, but they did get into the finals. If they knock off their cross-city rivals, then I think much will be forgiven. I'm not sure it should be, but it will be.
And again, I think that the fact that Melbourne City have been so inconsistent is the fact that it hasn't been clear in terms of their formation. Their style of play each week, it's changed.
It's changed radically from week to week. And I think you just have to ask Richie Delatt. I don't think he likes playing six different positions across the season, but he's
what do you mean? I'm sure he loves it.
I mean, maybe he's like to having to run up front. Everybody likes scoring goals and he's their leading goal scorer. But I think it's pointed to an inconsistency, not just because of injuries, but also, you know, Warren Joyce hasn't fallen upon a winning formula this season. He usually keeps his formation the same for the next week. If he wins a game, then they'll lose, then he changes it. And it's just been repeat, repeat, rinse and repeat. And I think there are deeper lying problems in that club that fall back on, you know, philosophy, not just the formation or the selection, but the philosophy and what's being instilled in the players at training, because, you know, they're not playing in a way that stretches defences. They're very, very deeply predictable in most games, and that has hurt them so much this season. When you look at players like Bart Schenkeveld, Jamie McLaren has come in, you know, Lockie Wales is a good example, Ryan Legree. These are guys who at A-League level should be game changers, should be delivering top-level performances week in, week out, and the structures that they've been asked to occupy have not really served that.
Well, especially Riley McGree, we know his best position is in the midfield.
And he's devastating when he's on his game. I mean, he scored a couple of goals against Wellington Phoenix. Lost that game in the dying moments, but he's a potential Socceroo of the future. I think he will be in the Socceroos lineup, but it's not going to be at left wing back. It's not going to be at number 10. It's going to be a number 8 where he excels, where he can make late runs into the box. And I don't think he's been another victim of inconsistency in and out of the team, in different positions, different formations, and, you know, in a structure that doesn't really give him the freedom to express himself.
Now, we know that football isn't won on paper, and I don't think that it's going to be 8-0 tonight, as Warren Joyce is hoping, even though they are playing bottom place Central Coast Mariners.
No, I don't think so either. This Mariners squad, there are deep problems in terms of the quality of players that they've got. The recruitment, I mean, I've pointed the fact that all of the seemingly 90% of the signings in the off-season came from one agent. I think, you know, you've got to look at that and think there's problems with the recruitment strategy and who's in charge of that. But bringing a new coach in, you can get that bounce, and they have had that bounce with Alan Stajic. He probably will stick around for next season. That hasn't been confirmed yet, but it seems all but a formality because he has had that impact to make them a little bit more competitive. And I think the one thing he's done, rather than a tactical or a selection change, has been mentality. Has been getting it into these players, giving them a bit of confidence and saying, you know, you can actually compete at this level, because they were down and out, you know, under the previous, well, 2-3 managers. So that's a powerful thing. And I think if these players can believe in themselves, if he can reintegrate people like Tom Hiarie and then get a little bit of support from the owner, who, you know, has been so heavily criticised and deservedly so in the off-season, then they could be competitive next campaign.
And they are coming off a win, a 3-1 win over the Western Sydney Wanderers.
I wouldn't read too much into that. The Wanderers were absolutely disgraceful in that game. Their midfield was nowhere to be seen. I was writing an article on it, and the Rolly Bonavazia popped up on the left wing with the ball in the second half, and I had to go back on my live score app and checked whether he'd started the game or come on at halftime as a sub, because I hadn't seen him. I hadn't noticed him. He was, you know, totally absent, and there are too many passengers in that Wanderers side. And Marcus Babbel summed it up pretty well after the game when he said, you know, players think they're better than they are and we lose games. I think there are some problems in that dressing room with, you know, players not being humble enough to work as hard as they need to.
I'm going to be writing an article on 5 young players who should have gotten more game time this whole A-League season that didn't. One of them is Mark Tokic. Why hasn't he been playing for the Western Sydney Wanderers? I just can't get my head around it.
Your guess is as good as mine, Louise. I think Marcus Babbel has been almost immune to criticism. He's a jovial character. He's good value for the league in terms of sound bites. I think the pedigree of his playing career, maybe journalists have given him a little bit of a break this season, even though the Wanderers have been fairly abject. they have problems in central midfield. That's been their biggest problem all campaign. Central midfield, centre back. And central midfield probably first on that list. It's what we pinpointed back in pre-season, before the season started. We thought Rashid Mahazi and who else plays in the holding midfield? Keanu Backus, the injured player. Help me out here. The former Adelaide player. People know what I mean. Not experienced or quality options in terms of shielding the defence. They need to bring somebody in that role. And Mark Tokic, maybe not a defensive-minded player. He's got some ability in that regard, but he's a natural ball player, and you've seen him a lot more than me. You'd be able to attest to the fact that he is...
He still has a defensive element to his game.
He's sort of a box-to-box. But he has a natural just ease with the ball.
He is very calm. Very calm.
Very calm, and I think next season he's one to look forward to. I would have rather to see him start more games this season considering the mess that the club were in, but you know, maybe next season will be a little bit more stable and a better atmosphere to integrate him into.
I'm even questioning whether he's sticking around next season because he hasn't even been on the bench. He's been a non-starter altogether.
Yeah. Yeah, that's disappointing, very disappointing. And, you know, I think the Wanderers are another team. We talk about Brisbane Roar's youth side. Wanderers have won a youth league quite recently and have a lot of good young players. That
last season.
If they don't integrate, then they'll lose them. And Mark Tokic, if he's not going to get first-team football at all next season, if he's not part of the setup, if he needs to have a frank conversation with Marcus Babbel and think, is he in the picture or not? If he's not, he should move clubs.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR with Josh Parrish and Louise Taffer. And Josh, you've lined up another guest for us.
I have indeed. I'm wearing the jumper on air as well. No one can really accuse me of being impartial in this situation, but it is topical, Louise. Northern New South Wales Football put out a media release today, you know, emphasising that they are obligated to enforce the National Club Identity Policy, the most controversial four letters in Australian football. And this comes after the FFA director himself, Joseph Carozzi, basically said the policy was dead and buried on his Twitter account. We've got Jim Sneesby from Hamilton at Zuri, the club which has maybe sparked all the controversy on the line. Jim, welcome to FNR.
Good evening, Josh and Louise. How are you guys tonight?
Yeah, we're really well, mate. More importantly, how are you and how did this situation develop? The controversy in question is regarding a tiny little Italian flag on the back of the shirt collars, am I right?
Correct. It's actually not just an Italian flag. We've got two sets of jerseys, a home and away kit, and on the away kit there's a small Ukrainian trezor on it. Not sure if you've seen a Ukrainian trezor before, small little symbol?
No, I haven't.
I don't think Northern New South Wales actually know what the symbol means, but that's essentially it. I'll go through the background for you. So with the home kit, approximately 18 months ago, we ordered a new home kit. We got it from a friend who was overseas in America. We're not big on politics in Australia, particularly football politics. Didn't even know this thing exists. Ordered these jerseys. They came back with a small Italian flag on the back. Didn't think anything of it. And then we realised quite quickly that we needed an away kit. So we got a yellow one. And around that time, my pop's from Ukraine. He was taken from Ukraine at about the age of 13 or 14 by the Germans, who Germans got the Nazis. He was made to do slave labour, and through that, he met my grandma, who was a German. And essentially, they moved from country to country due to the fact that they couldn't find work because you had a Ukrainian and a German together, until they eventually got to Australia. And my pop actually did a lot of work with us initially setting up the club. And he passed away. So we actually made that as a commemorative jersey for him, that away kit. So we've been wearing them for about almost 2 years now with no problem.
And have any officials from Northern New South Wales Football been in attendance at any of your games when, you know, these jerseys have been worn?
Oh, yeah. We actually played at Northern New South Wales ground. So they've got a brand new facility out at Lake Macquarie. It's fantastic. All these pitches are beautiful. And we played a few games out there, and we played a few games where we were watched very closely by officials as well.
So what penalties have been threatened?
Well, this is half the issue. We're not actually sure what the consequences might be. We haven't been told. We've just been essentially to immediately get rid of the kit. So we were given, this was on Wednesday afternoon, and considering it was a public holiday yesterday, we were essentially given today to find 42 new kits.
And not to mention the inconvenience, but what would be the cost involved for a, you know, State League 4 community club to get a whole new playing kit in one day?
Well, considering they had to get numbered as well, around $1,000. And considering, like you say, we're fourth division club in Newcastle, we don't have those funds. We operate at zero, essentially.
And looking through the leagues that you play in, you know, Northern New South Wales, there seems to be a few clubs that are, you know, pretty closely associated with various ethnic groups and various national groups. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but can you pinpoint a few of those for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, we think it's fantastic. We have Broadmeadow Magic, who are a Macedonian club. They're proud. They've got a Macedonian symbol in their emblem, which, again, fantastic. We have Hamilton Olympic, who are a Greek side. Charlestown City Blues, who are currently, we know their current perils, trying to get the Azzurri name back. They're an Italian club. But another one that sort of people don't recognise as well is New Anthem Jaffers. They must be a Scottish club because there's a Scottish flower in their emblem as well.
And I've heard rumours of a gag rule on Twitter for members of Hamilton Azzurri. Is this something that the Northern New South Wales has contacted you and enforced? Or
They haven't contacted me directly. However, I'm not sure whether that gag goes to radio. So, look, they didn't say radio specifically, so I reckon I'm all right.
So I do
want to mention as well, sorry, before I go any further, that my views are definitely my own and not Hamilton Azzurri. So if anyone was listening and wanted to punish anyone, please do it to me individual and not the club.
Well, Jim, you know, our sympathies go out to you and everybody else who are supporters of this club. I mean, we've seen plenty of videos online about the, you know, fantastic passion that you all display supporting this community team and progression in the FFA Cup, which is fantastic to see. We just hope here at FNR, you know, we're trying to defend the game's history, the contribution of migrant groups to Australian football. And, you know, FFA themselves have said this policy is no longer in keeping with our values and they're developing a new one. So from all of us at FNR, we just hope that the common sense prevails.
Thank you so much. And thank you for all that you guys do. Like, it's an amazing service you guys provide. And thanks for having us on. Thanks for the support. We see you wearing our jumper a lot, and that's really awesome. The boys get a real kick out of it. And look, at the end of the day, we just want to play football. That's all we want to do. We're a bunch of mates who want to play football. That's all.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck and all best for the future.
Thanks so much, Justin Louise. Really appreciate it.
Jim Sneesby, a passionate supporter at Hamilton Azzurri, who are a fourth tier State League 4 community club in Northern New South Wales, just near Newcastle. And apparently Northern New South Wales football have seen fit to crack down on, you know, this bunch of people who are just trying to play football and support the club that they love and pay tribute to the history of that club.
This must be one of the only member federations that are actually doing that, though.
I haven't seen or heard any other member federation since FFA made the announcement, crack down on the basis of NCIP.
I mean, we covered this like 2 months ago.
Yeah.
If FFA have already abolished NCIP, why is this happening? I don't get it. And that means FFA need to intervene and overstep Northern New South Wales, in my opinion.
I think they need to have a quiet word. This is the Northern New South Wales football statement for the record. They've put this out this morning. FFA Director Joseph Carozzi has clarified that the NCIP remains in force until the new diversity and inclusiveness policy is endorsed by the FFA board. In response, all member federations and competition administrators are obligated to uphold the terms of the current policy. And they've quoted the policy there. We all know what it is. Northern New South Wales football does not have the autonomy to pick and choose when national policies are upheld. All affiliated clubs, including Hamilton Azzurri, are obligated in accordance with the National Registration Regulations to abide by national policy, which underpins the governance of the game. And Northern New South Wales football will continue to uphold national policy without fear or favour. No further comment will be made. I just think this is out of line. I think it's spiteful. I think it's cruel and unusual to enforce this lame duck policy in such a way that's so, you know, it seems like picking on one club in particular.
But it's like, okay, if Joseph Carozzi has said that it actually hasn't been enforced yet.
He hasn't said that publicly.
I can understand that. You're right. He hasn't said it publicly.
He was tweeted by, I think, Jim Sneesby, the man we just had on, asking whether it was still in place. And he said, no, this has been abolished. We had a board meeting. And that tweet is still up. You can go look at Joseph Carozzi's Twitter page if you like.
But now he's saying it's still enforced.
Well, that's what New South Wales are saying that he said. Maybe we don't know what's happened, what's said being behind closed doors. But regardless,
there's a communication breakdown.
There's a massive...
enforced or it's not.
And it's a lame duck policy. This is the grey area that Jonathan Howcroft mentioned when we asked him. You know, it's maybe it's still in play until the new, whatever the new diversity inclusion policy contains. I don't think there's a need for a new policy. I think you just abolish it because...
But that's the other question. What does the new policy include?
I guess it's probably just a watered down version of the old one. And I just don't think it's necessary. It wasn't in place for a century of Australian football. It was only introduced in 2014, just before the first FFA Cup started. Maybe an attempt to, you know, quote-unquote, sanitise the lower tiers of football before the Fox Sports cameras turned up. It was never necessary. It's not necessary now. It's out of step with, you know, modern values of inclusiveness. It was meant, maybe it was brought in with good intentions, but it's obviously not, you know, serving multiculturalism. It's actually censoring it. So get rid of it, FFA. It's a no-brainer. You've got to tap Northern New South Wales football on the shoulder and say, guys, this is not on. We're getting rid of this for a reason. And you don't have to be, you know, the crusaders on the part of NCIP when it's no longer going to be in place.
Any more on that before we move on?
I think I've said all that needs to be said on that. And I hope we don't have to talk about it ever again until the day that it is totally and unequivocally abolished.
Hear, hear. All right, now, going back to the A-League, we have a distance derby as well in the final round of the 2018-19 series. How do you think this will go? Will Perth Glory field a stronger side?
Well, it is at home, so potentially, but I still think they'll rest a few players. I think the rotations will continue. It's a weird fixture because of the state of the finals. These two teams could play each other in a couple of weeks, of course, if Wellington Phoenix win their elimination final. I think there will be players rested. They've omitted a few of the younger guys like Jacob Italiano and Brandon Wilson, but I think you might see a Jake Brimmer start, maybe a Fabio Ferreira. So I think you'll see a similar approach to the last game, the Perth-Sydney game, with a few of the senior players coming out, a handful of younger or bench options coming in. And Tony Popovich will try and keep that rolling, keep the legs fresh enough, but also, you know, get a win to maybe carry them into finals football on a positive note.
I'd be really interested to see how Wellington Phoenix go. Given the news of Mark Rudin and the fact that he is stepping away from the club, at an interesting point in time, we're heading into the final series. Wellington Phoenix haven't featured in the final series for quite some time. And it'd just be interesting to see the mindset of the players and where they're at the moment.
Yeah, it's a curious one because Mark Rudin is departing and there's obviously a lot of emotions pent up in that. I just hope that they can rediscover, you know, that win against Melbourne City is a huge one. I think it will be a huge boost for morale, but I hope they can rediscover the kind of football they were playing earlier on. The loss of Louis Fenton, I think, has been a little bit more sorely felt than maybe we thought, but David Williams moving into that right-sided role against City, very attacking option there, of course.
But unexpected.
Seemed to work well. And I also like Kieran Sheridan as a bench option because he hasn't scored. I don't think he scored yet. Maybe one goal. But he does bring other players into the game and he does change things up front. So Max Burgess, huge revelation this season. Sarpreet Singh, Roy Krishner, of course, could be a Johnny Warren medalist. And David Williams maybe shuttling in that right wing back role. That's a dangerous combination of players, and I think they can cause some damage in the final series. If they meet Perth in the semi-final, potentially, I mean, they'd be massive underdogs, especially playing away from home. But they've been a good news story, and I hope they do well.
Roy Krishner still leading the A-League Golden Boot race on 18, two ahead of Adam Lafondre.
He's been sensational, absolutely sensational this season. And I think he's been performing at a similar level for quite some time in a much worse team that didn't give him the service. Now he's got a better team around him. You can see what a great player he really is. Perhaps the greatest Fijian player in history. I think there was one other player who played in the NSL that his name temporarily escapes me. It was a few decades ago before my time. But I think he deserves the Johnny Warren medal. I think he's right in the top three with maybe Ninkovic and Diego Castro.
Yeah, I would say that.
Chris Economides, maybe.
Ole Toivonen, he's been outstanding for me.
I don't think he's a Johnny Warren medalist. I think he's had too many games where he's either missed through injury or he hasn't impacted. There's been a number of games where he's been sensational, but I just think he's been too inconsistent. So, and this is talking about the very top players in the league, and you know, on that level, Diego Castro, every game he's played, he's influenced in such a spectacular way, and you know, his contract extension is just proof of how important he still is.
And speaking of contract extension, Keske Honda, James Troisi, Costa Barbarousa, just some of the names who might be departing at the end of the season for Melbourne Victory.
Well, Louise, I think we should have a look at European football before we go on this Friday. There's plenty of important matches coming up on the weekend. In the Premier League, such a tight title race. 1 point in it. Liverpool take on Huddersfield and Burnley take on Manchester City. I'd be interested in getting your predictions for these games.
Look, I don't think Liverpool will take out the EPL title. I don't think that they'll do it because they have the UEFA Champions League. We know that their first leg is away to Barcelona. I think they'll be gearing up for that. And Manchester City are only in the FA Cup. I think Manchester City have it in their hand at the moment. I know a lot of Liverpool fans won't like to hear that, but I guess the game at the weekend against Huddersfield is pretty straightforward. Huddersfield are already relegated, so I don't think they really pose a threat to Liverpool. Liverpool should take 3 points in this one, though.
Yeah, I think both sides will win. I can see Burnley making things difficult just because of the kind of team they are.
Against City.
Yeah, they're very physical, but City have had the wood over them all season long. I do think because Liverpool have to play that Champions League semi-final and City have that one-point advantage, Liverpool have tougher fixtures coming up. I think this is in Manchester City's hands, which is a little bit disappointing because, you know, it's sort of the default outcome for the season. The most well-resourced, well-coached team, just they haven't strolled to the championship. It's been a great title race, but I just don't think Liverpool, you know, can overcome. They might win all three of their games, but I just don't think that Manchester City are going to slip up.
No, I don't either. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the UEFA Champions League. I think Barcelona will also be too tough a test.
Yeah, I think so too. I just think they're so good defensively.
They're just complete.
Messi can change games on a dime, as we've seen all season. But continuing with this weekend's games in the Premier League, Manchester United versus Chelsea, huge game for the outcome of the top four.
Massive. Manchester United's aim is to make the top four. It'll be a massive loss if they don't make Champions League football next season. But, I mean, nothing really surprises me these days with that squad. It's been so up and down. We saw when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer came in, he turned it around for a couple of rounds and now it's just gone backwards.
And I think the true nature of their squad and their quality lies somewhere in between the extreme of that massive run and the current slump that they're in. I think this will be a draw. I think Chelsea have enough about them. Eden Hazard, you know, he's such a sensational player when he wants to be. Both teams have a lot to play for, but that will open up the window for Arsenal, who take on Leicester City in the early kickoff on Sunday.
And Arsenal lost against Wolves.
And they lost against Crystal Palace. They're on a bad run recently.
This is an away game. Arsenal's away form is shocking, and it has been this season.
It has been all season long. Someone said the other day that Arsenal never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And I think they will have the two teams around them slip up with that draw, and I think they will probably lose or draw against Leicester City.
I want to give you a stat that's come past my desk this morning. Manchester United have gone 527 minutes without scoring from open play in all competitions.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I mean, they have the caliber of players in that team in the forward line that should be able to score goals. I think it's the functioning of the midfield and the way that they're unable to control games in possession and create chances that way that means that they rely on counterattacks, and that's what they had in those early runs at Solskjaer. I think teams have found them out a little bit and have been defending well against the fast counterattack, and the players, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is complained of the lack of conditioning. And they're not able to play the pressing game that he wants to play. And maybe that's a swipe at Mourinho, but I think it's also true. And, you know, when you have that passive defensive game plan that Mourinho wanted, where you're sitting back behind the ball, you know, that's out of touch with modern football, but the players aren't conditioned to play a high pressing game. So I think they've run out of legs.
We also heard today that Manchester United's Romelu Lukaku has said that it's his dream to play in Serie A. I think I've heard it all now.
Serie A. Lukaku in Serie A. That's a thought.
Isn't it?
What has happened to him? He's put on seemingly a lot of weight. I'm not sure
if
it's muscle.
He's fallen behind Marcus Rashford.
Yeah, he has, and with good reason. His touch isn't good enough. He seems far less mobile than he was in his Everton days, and I wonder what's gone off the rails for him, because you know when he was playing as a youngster in Belgium and even for Everton, he looked like the next big thing. He looks like the next Didier Drogba, and it seems to be his career is tailing off rapidly.
I don't think he'll be at the club next season. But that's all we've got time for today, Josh. And one final thing, if Barcelona do beat Levante on Sunday, they wrap up the La Liga title.
And I think they will. Levante, a weird team that seemed to cause some problems in big games, but I think Barcelona have enough about them and they're going to wrap the title up at some point. It may as well be this weekend.
Hear. All right, Josh, thank you for your company and thank you for your company at home. That's all we've got time for. Tune in again on Monday at the same time.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.